Okay, Marshall, I'm ready to start. 60 Minutes. The modern system of government factory schooling is based upon a negative faith in human nature, a belief that ordinary people cannot accomplish much, will not work hard unless coerced, must be wrenched away from parental and community influence as soon as possible, and will inevitably work for the balance of their post-school lives, if they work at all, in huge employment pyramids established by governments, corporations, and institutions. Employment pyramids managed and directed by professionalized elites. These postulates are central to the geometry of government schooling, and they make up a constellation of expert opinion which Abraham Lincoln, back in 1859, speaking before the Wisconsin Agricultural Association, called Mudsill Theory, because at that time it concentrated its force on contempt for villages, towns, and farms where people lived simply in dwellings with baked mud door sills. This fervently held belief about mass human incapacity has become axiomatic in our own time, but to Lincoln and many Americans before him, it would have been considered outrageous, even wicked. While common opinion in the United States before the advent of academic psychology held that all human beings shared a spiritual flaw which prevented even the best people from being completely trustworthy, it was still widely believed that prodigies of self-improvement and growing wisdom were available to everyone who worked hard for them. God helped those who helped themselves. In the America of Andrew Jackson, that was just the plain truth. What a radical notion that in innocent democratic times spawned. Where had its like ever been seen before? The crazy notion that social class was porous, that while there was universal sin, there was also universal redemption available to anyone who struggled. But nobody sensible thought that someone else could do this for you. Nobody thought you could just be passively taught to improve yourself. You had to learn, for the most part, by teaching yourself. The negative postulates which replaced this hard-nosed optimism after mass forced government schooling came about at the beginning of the 20th century were not drawn from the Jacksonian America, but from the historic outlook of the British nobility and from the British state religion as it had been created by the Tudor kings. It was a perspective which once had been so violently unacceptable to Americans, we picked up guns to rid ourselves of it, and thank God we had guns to pick up, as the ordinary Englishman or German did not. However, by the second half of the 19th century, a powerful dependence on English bankers to finance American factory growth and westward expansion caused the outlook of the British gentry to creep back into the drawing room conversations in Boston and New York and Philadelphia and into the thinking of business leaders. One very famous intellectual bloodline between 1800 and 1900 supplied the mainstream of scientific argument against our libertarian interpretation of human possibility. America's principal contribution to history, as I reckon things. Out of this noteworthy bloodline rose three cousins, Thomas Malthus, Charles Darwin, and Francis Galton, whose work, though confined to the 19th century, has profoundly influenced 20th century schooling and whose ideas threaten to control absolutely 21st century society. Thomas Malthus, cousin number one, wrote the great essay on population, which I'm sure all of you read as freshmen in college, which announced that the number of births would always outstrip the food supply, a conclusion sending chills through the entire British, German, American elite establishment. Nothing could halt the inexorable march of mathematics, said Malthus. And so it was far kinder in the long run to be exceedingly cruel, isolating the poor and working them to death on starvation rations. By no stretch of the imagination should they ever be educated. That would make their management impossible. I should translate that expression, the poor, into precise mathematical terms. In Germany, it was presumed by 1806 that no more than 6% of the population could be afforded an education. In England, which was far more liberal, the figure arrived at was 8%. And in the United States, the most liberal of the three, 20% was considered the outside figure. In the middle of the 19th century, cousin number two, Charles Darwin, said people were descended from protozoic particles through an endless living chain which had no other meaning than to kill off its weakest links and grow more efficient. What sane public policy was about, according to Darwin, was allowing the strongest to reproduce themselves more efficiently, whatever that took. The word education had absolutely no meaning in Darwinian reality except as it pertained to the interests of the best biological stock. Darwin's second book, which is never talked or even whispered about, Descent of Man, written in 1871, took the case even further, calling for society's leaders to take radical steps to keep lower order organisms from breeding with higher order organisms. If the breeding stocks were crossed, said Darwin, the human race would go crashing down the ladder of evolution into the primordial slime from which it had come. Descent of Man appeared just at the moment of the first strong upper-class push for mass compulsion schooling to Americanize immigrants. It provided a compelling intellectual and visionary goal for the progressive architects of schooling. In 1882, the most powerful men in America held a great celebratory dinner for the most famous evolutionary thinker in the world at Delmonico's Hotel in New York City. It's worth a trip to the microfilm to read about this meeting. For philosopher Herbert Spencer, during which time they presented Spencer with an enormous fortune in gold as a tribute of their affection for his teaching the world the sacred doctrine, survival of the fittest, and how it was best for everyone, even for the biologically hopeless, to eliminate them by shortening their period of pain. The dinner for Spencer marked symbolically the moment that the future of American mass compulsion schooling was decided for the upcoming century. It would be a line of defense against an evolutionary catastrophe. Here was mudsill theory, but with a mathematico-scientific twist. Nothing could be done to help the lesser races anyway. Malthus had demonstrated it mathematically, Darwin biologically. Keeping nature's mistakes in total ignorance was the most merciful thing until a final solution could be worked out. Cousin number three, Francis Galton, was in many ways the pick of the litter. He worked out a variety of impressive techniques to ensure that the best could be identified and isolated together to breed with the best, leaving the worst to be gradually bred out of existence. Galton was the chief creator and distributor of statistical numbers games, like the ones that infest Anglo-American and now global scholarship. The number crunching that dominates government and commercial industrial thinking these days. Galton's breeding scheme required a state-managed school training sequence in which the mass of ordinary citizens were continually numbered and classified. Does this sound familiar? Galton also required universal licensing practices, where those certified acceptable through schooling would be assured incomes sufficient to breed and nurture successfully, according to the judgment and dictates of the best people. He wrote the definitive book on the inheritance of intelligence and the inheritance of stupidity. He invented the science of eugenics. He created forced government sterilization legislation to be used on the unfit. And he saw to it, by a number of trips to the United States that his followers here enacted and tested forced sterilization legislation in various parts of America by 1906. The American government's involuntary sterilization precedents became the direct model for Nazi Germany's forced sterilization program three decades later. Another historical fact which seems to have slipped through the cracks. Galton urged human breeding experiments on a massive scale using forced schooling and elite control of mass media to implant correct attitudes and values in ordinary minds. Family and local sovereignties were to be replaced with expert centralized control personnel equipped with weapons of positive and negative reinforcement made possible by elite control over the economy and the police power. In America, Galton's program was bankrolled and overseen by Andrew Carnegie principally, J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller, elements in the Whitney, the Sage, the Astor, the Peabody, and Vanderbilt families, and by others of similar prominence, although the total list is not large. Mass 20th century forced schooling was from the first a project guided and approved at the highest levels of society. It was a blessed coincidence that a similar interest in controlling children existed among various socialistic factions, providing a convenient cover behind which the much more powerful and effective men and women worked for a much different ultimate end. Yet the intermediary goal of both parties, whether Marxist or magnate, was identical: control of children's minds, because through children, total social control on a new order of magnitude seemed possible. So keep in mind as we continue that from 1800 to 1900, one British family of enormous influence provided mathematical and scientific reasons why the dumb should be kept dumb and couldn't be anything else. The rise of the behavioral psychologies out of Germany at the very same time further underscored that children could not accomplish anything much unless coerced, tricked, or bribed, and that they should be cared for by attendants all their days. As I said earlier, these postulates were dubbed mudsill theory by Abe Lincoln when he first heard them in 1859 and set out to contest them. Naturally, he knew nothing of Darwin and Galton, but he did know Malthus. And more than Malthus, he knew the philosophy of the British Empire and the theology of the state religion of England, which said that the social order was divinely ordained and it was sacrilegious to attempt to move people from one class to another. Two conditions echoed perfectly in the science of Darwin and the science of Galton yet to come. "Look about you," said Lincoln. "America has the best educated people in history, and all their learning is managed locally or personally. The mission of the United States, the only justification for its independent existence from Britain, was to, quote, raise up the ordinary and make every man really free and independent. Whatever schooling we entertain should always be dedicated to the principle of independent livelihoods and self-reliant families," which was just what the about-to-be-scorned class of mudsill Americans already enjoyed. Is there any evidence that Lincoln's faith in ordinary Americans was justified? Yes, there is. A book from the Cornell University Press, published in 1990, called Roots of Rural Capitalism, explored the inspirational labor economy of the 1840s, where independent livelihoods were aimed for and to a very great degree achieved. It was an economy shaped by family concerns, not by accountants' bottom lines. Personal farming and craft businesses took precedence, then family duties. Any hard work outside had to adapt to these central community concerns. As a consequence, rural manufacture had a friendly character. Quite unlike the British and European counterpart, there was no debased proletariat here to kick around. Wage labor was only a supplement to a comprehensive strategy of household economy in which the goal was always self-sufficiency in food, clothing, construction, furnishings, candles, entertainment, medical care, old age assistance. Marriages, as Alan Carlson has shown us, were partnerships of home-centered work. By age five, children were active participants in the work and life of the household, and still are today among the Amish. The normal family produced its own life. It was not a mere association of consumers. Even then, of course, people worked for each other. But the common understanding was that a whole lifetime spent this way was a form of slavery. You worked for another for experience and for the purpose of assembling a stake to strike out on your own. Now consider to what extent a successful tradition of self-reliance we once had, like the one we once had, requires an official public attitude of faith in human possibility to sustain it. If the background music is a mudsill symphony, then only a few will be able to dance as they choose. Before an economy of independent livelihoods, as we had in Lincoln's day, can be broken apart and scavenged for its labor units, people first have to be brought to doubt themselves by a pessimistic appraisal of human potential. They have to be graded into classes from early childhood and conditioned to move to the drill of bells, trained like rats. By the year 1900, two school roads lay before us as a nation. One leading to an economy of small independent proprietors, close family life, and a climate of trust that common people can largely educate and regulate themselves. It was a one and two room schoolhouse road, its technique based on what had been proven so amply in the first century of our new nation's history, a road which had visited the privileges of gentry on an impressive number of ordinary lives by trusting them to do the best for themselves. But a competing theory was now active. From the reintroduction of English money and English attitude into the United States to finance our burgeoning industry, which would win the contest for mastery over American 20th century schooling? The libertarian ideal which had granted us a huge advantage over our English and German competitors, with a more ancient notion of proper class subordination, which made life for the ordinary bloke so relatively degraded in those competitive countries. I want to answer my own question indirectly by presenting a mystery to you, which I'll call the reading mystery. Almost five decades ago, people at the Defense Department knew something weird was going on in American schools by comparing literacy rates among World War II inductees with those from the Korean War. Between 1941 and 1944, 18 million men schooled in the 1930s showed up at registration offices and were tested for literacy. 96% of them passed. A few years later, less than a decade, in 1950, another war began in Korea, for which about 3 million were tested. This was a group schooled in the 1940s, schooled for many more hours and many more years by more professionally trained school teachers. If schooling was good for us, this group should have reflected it. By its end, the number of men found non-inductible because they could not read safety manuals, interpret road signs, translate orders into actions, and so on, the number of illiterates, in other words, had reached 27% of the total pool. Same literacy test. But the 4% illiteracy of 1941, which had become 19% in 1952, was now 27% in 1970. A disaster had occurred underneath our noses in a short 30 years, and a substantial chunk of even the supposedly literate were just barely so. They could not read independently to learn. They could not sustain a thought or an argument. They could not read for pleasure. They could not read a newspaper to look for work or keep up with events. By 1993, the U.S. Department of Education reluctantly admitted that almost half the adult population could barely read at all. And 3 years later, in 1996, the American Management Association reported that 33% of American college graduates could neither read nor calculate well enough to perform the jobs they sought. And in the same year, the wealthiest state in America, California, turned in the worst reading performance in the United States. Less might be more from a philosophical perspective, but where American schooling was concerned, more had resoundingly demonstrated that it was really less. To academic insiders and other mudsill theorists, the explanation for the sharp drop in performance was biological. In a much-discussed bestseller of 1994 called The Bell Curve, several highly respected social scientists, Murray and Herrnstein, explained that we were seeing the natural result of selective breeding in a high-tech society, producing impressive mathematics to show that smart people were getting together with smart people and dumb people with dumb people, so that children of the respective groups were diverging sharply. But nowhere in that book's pages was there any awareness of the massive military data patiently accumulated between 1941 and 1970 to disprove their contention, for not even the boldest survival of the fittest proponent would attempt to argue that declines of this magnitude could happen so quickly. But if not heredity, what could explain these phenomena? Try this. Under cover of World War II, American public schools were forcibly converted by teacher colleges, textbook publishers, foundations, think tanks, state departments of education, and other outside agents to non-phonetic ways of teaching reading. On the matter of violence alone, this new illiteracy seems to have had considerable impact. Justice Department studies, one of them quite recent, report that 85% of the violent criminal population incarcerated is illiterate. Researchers hypothesize a connection between the humiliation poor readers regularly endure and the development of antisocial attitudes. I'm not a big fan of this kind of theorizing, but that certainly seems to be the kind you'd get in your neighborhood bar, and it seems to me absolutely correct. As reading ability plummeted in America, juvenile crime soared. Bizarre violence became commonplace in the daily life of ordinary Americans, and illegitimacy doubled, then redoubled again. But keep in mind that illiteracy came first. The change in schools that began to be noticeable in the 1940s and produced its first crisis in 1952 had actually begun four decades earlier at the turn of the century. Modern schooling as we know it, compulsory, standardized, dumbed down, and nationalized in all but name, mudsill schooling, as Abe Lincoln would have called it, begins when for the first time compulsory attendance laws are widely enforced by the police, the courts, by a social work surveillance and intimidation network, and through heavy use of public relations and Chautauqua to drive parents to believe that their children would be disadvantaged without schooling. It was during these turn-of-the-century years that for the first time, the general public was aggressively led to believe that schooling and education were the same thing, and of course they are not, and few had ever believed that before. There are many complex reasons this was done, Malthus, Darwin, and Galton among them, but mass immigration at the end of the last century and the beginning of this one was certainly the trigger event, frightening otherwise sensible people into the pro-schooling camp. Different interest groups backed compulsion schooling for different reasons. The most important one, businessmen wanted a workforce disciplined and trained like Germany's was, whose industry at that time was considered state-of-the-art. Social conservatives felt threatened by the terrifying changes immigration was wreaking on American cohesion, and they wanted the newcomers rapidly socialized as Americans. some thought of socialization in a different and revolutionary way. They wanted to build a new social order and looked upon the confinement of children as an easy way to do that invisibly under the noses of parents, churches, and society. Some thought institutional schools would create more employment opportunities for women. Some were ideological utopians who believed with Plato and Rousseau that first you had to wipe the slate clear before you could reprogram young minds. Some sought to revive the weakened calling of the ministry. All these groups were different. Some wouldn't even have talked to each other, but all had the same purpose in mind, getting control of the levers of mass schooling. So some sought to revive the weakened calling of the ministry by translating church liturgy into a street liturgy of reform bearing the name the social gospel. And some few just wanted everyone to be able to read, write, and count, and they thought professionals could do this better than amateurs. But note well that even this last common sense group had lost its trust in people who lived in the new cities to continue to do what Americans in the country had been doing for centuries, educating themselves out of God-given curiosity and self-interest. Even a superficial examination of America's past and its institutions reveals that so-called public schools are the mirror of mudsill theory in action, proving grounds for a negative theory of human nature which belies the romantic rhetoric of equal opportunity. Modern schooling is a substitute for religious faith. It is a civil religion whose goals on the policy level are not reading, writing, arithmetic, and thinking. The religious purpose of modern schooling was announced loudly by the legendary University of Wisconsin sociologist Edward A. Ross. When you hear the name Ross, you're talking about one of the three or four people who created the new discipline of sociology in this part of the world. He wrote a book in 1906 called Social Control. Your librarian will have no trouble turning up a copy of this book for you. In it, Ross wrote these words for those important academic and industrialist eyes among his wide following. I'm quoting directly now from Social Control. Plans are underway to replace community, family, and church with propaganda, schooling, and mass media. The state shakes loose from the church, reaches out to the school. People are only little plastic lumps of dough. Now, he didn't have a cape with the collar turned up, and it wasn't a dark room. It's a book by a major publisher from a major university. There you have it in a nutshell, the whole problem with modern schooling. It rests on a nest of false premises. People are not little plastic lumps of dough. They are not blank tablets, as John Locke said they were. Any mother could tell you that. They are not machines, as Lemaitre stated. They are not vegetables, as Frederick Froebel, the inventor of kindergartens, hypothesized. They are not organic mechanisms, as Wilhelm Wundt taught every single psychology department in America at the turn of the century. They are not, quote, repertoires of behavior, as John Watson or B.F. Skinner, the behaviorist, claimed. They are not even, as the new crop of systems thinkers have it, mystically harmonious microsystems interlocking with grand macrosystems in a dance of atomic forces. Now, you break the guy's nose right there and see whether he seems... We needn't be crazy about this. Locked in a lecture hall or a bull session, there's no more harm in such nonsense than there is in reading too many Italian sonnets all at one sitting. But used as the basis for school experiments, each of these suppositions leads to frightfully oppressive practices. As several of the speakers earlier today said, ideas do have consequences. People are not little plastic lumps of dough, and shaking loose from community, family, and church has ruined a lot of lives already and promises to ruin many millions more before and if we can end its career. One of the most pernicious ideas that empty child thinking of this sort led to was the notion that human breeding could be synthetically enhanced or retarded as plant and animal breeding is, by scientific gardeners and husbandmen. Nobody who has ever heard of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment or the deliberate nuclear pollution downwind of Hanford in eastern Washington to observe the effects of radiation on Americans who were used without their knowledge as laboratory subjects, and nobody who has heard of the CIA's MK Ultra project, which randomly created and then distributed the drug LSD in America to chart its effects on ordinary people, should have any trouble understanding that at some point our government lost any restraint about subjecting its unwitting citizens to medical experimentation, and it didn't begin with the Clinton administration. It has been a succession of political administrations, Democrat and Republican, for a long, long time. They did this just exactly as if individual lives meant nothing, just exactly as if mudsill theory were true. The massive Ritalin experiment going on right now in American public schools is only a more recent illustration of the little plastic lumps of dough attitude at work. Back at the start of the 20th century, the monstrously influential Edward Thorndike of Columbia Teachers College, whose dictionary I'll bet lives in some of your homes, said publicly that modern schools would establish the conditions for, I'm quoting directly from his book, selective breeding before the masses take things into their own hands, whatever that's supposed to mean. Thorndike said that eventually the ranks and labels produced by national testing could be used as a basis to issue jobs, licenses to marry and hold office, or to have children. Another major architect of standardized testing, H.H. Goddard, a member of the family for whom the Space Center is named, head of the psychology department at Princeton, said in his book, Human Efficiency, that's 1920, your librarian will have no difficulty obtaining this book for you, that government schooling was all about, I'll quote, the perfect organization of the hive. He said that standardized testing, listen to this, was a way to make the lower classes recognize their own inferiority, like wearing a dunce cap. It would discourage them from having ambitions, and eventually it would discourage them from breeding at all. If Goddard had been just a dumb academic hack spouting this radical screed, you might take this as noise, but he was head of the Department of Psychology at Princeton. Imagine the effects his doctrines had on the 375 doctoral candidates he coached. Coming a bit closer to the present day, Dr. Shirley McCune, senior director of the Mid-Continent Education Laboratory, addressed the 50 governors of the United States in 1989 in Wichita, Kansas. President Clinton was in the audience when Dr. McCune said, quote, we're into the total restructuring of society. What is happening in America today, in Kansas and the Great Plains and elsewhere, is not a chance situation. What it amounts to is a total transformation of society. Now, just who exactly is the we that Shirley is talking about? And what is society being restructured into that it requires forced government schooling to dumb down children so thoroughly? Well, I've certainly painted a gloomy picture for you of mudsill theory. Tracing some of its movements as it overwhelmed the older traditional American faith and trust in individuals and in local leadership. This bleak outlook on human nature, as I told you twice before, was the gift to us of the English and German upper classes and the state religions of those two countries. Just as the libertarian, self-sufficient, communitarian ideal it replaced was the gift to us of the independent and dissenting religionists who migrated to this land to escape the tentacles of centralized regulation and the orthodoxy which held England and Europe tightly in thrall. Now I want to show you that all is not lost, that there are successful refutations of mudsill theory all around us to observe, to draw strength from, and to emulate. Let me start with Stanley, who was a 13-year-old Greek boy I had as a student not so long ago. Stanley was a truant who came to school only about one day a month. And when I was ordered to investigate Stanley, I found that he was cutting school to apprentice himself to his five aunts and uncles, one after another, all of them in business for themselves before they were 21, and all immigrants. This way, said Stanley, I decide which business I like well enough to set up in for myself. And he further added, I don't have time to waste in school if I don't want to end up like the rest of these jerks working for somebody else. Lincoln would know what he was talking about. When I heard that, I nearly choked. But I covered for Stanley ever after. Or how about the embarrassing story of Jaime Escalante, a Peruvian immigrant math teacher getting on in years, just like I am, who wears a golf cap and looks like an angry truck driver in his photos. When I caught up to Escalante in print, he had already been made famous by the film Stand and Deliver, but unbeknownst to the average filmgoer, Escalante's years at Garfield High were marked by a steady barrage of harassment, sabotage, character assassination, and vilification by his co-workers and by school administrators. They say he was a fake. Who are we to believe? Was he a fake? Was he a genuine threat to the belief that ordinary children cannot accomplish much? Fortunately, we don't have to guess in his case. When Escalante came to Garfield in 1974, the Western Association of Schools had threatened to revoke its accreditation. I think they did that to 20 schools out of 7 or 8 or 9,000 in the state. The kids he had to work with had no easy lives, they had no traditions of scholarship, and they were largely Mexican kids, not Peruvian kids, and there's a huge gulf between the two cultures, so he had no advantage from being able to speak Spanish. Keep this in mind as the baseline on which I'm going to stand my argument. By 1987, only three public schools in the nation were producing more advanced placement calculus students than Garfield.
This is the end of side one. Side two is
in the nation were producing more advanced placement calculus students than Garfield. His percentage of students passing the difficult second year advanced placement calculus tests was the highest in the state of California, higher than Palo Alto, higher than Palm Springs, higher than Hollywood Highs. The full implications of this data, I believe, are tremendously shocking, because they tend to suggest that the real role of orthodox government schooling is as a governor to control the rate and extent of learning, or even to prevent it. What you and I are really talking about is the Darwinian attitude that most of us are hopeless anyway and useless in any case. Although the proposition is usually stated in pseudoscientific language, or even worse, in the airy dreams of social workers, blunt words are a lot more accurate and honorable. This is the attitude which has driven the managers of government schooling for nearly a century, drives them at this moment. What Abraham Lincoln called mudsill theory is alive and well all over the policy circles of America. It races through the corridors of key foundations and think tanks. It is the lingua franca of America's influential universities. It infests the boardrooms of global corporations. The wholesale denial that ordinary people can be intellectually competent and lead moral lives without mind policing gathered itself politically in the United States between the years 1890 and 1920. It was always framed in the language of laboratory and university, but behind the stuffy words and brain-deadening charts and statistical chants, it was not difficult to make out the hands of Malthus, Darwin, and Galton, and behind them, the state religions of Britain and Germany, teaching that social class and subordination are divinely ordained. This attitude led directly to a decisive deconstruction of schooling for intelligence, a deconstruction which accelerated rapidly after World War II and raced ahead after the cleverly manipulated Sputnik hysteria of the late 1950s. How impossible would it be in the current economic climate to once again set our caps in our schools to teach the central value of independent livelihoods, as was true in the days of Washington and Jackson and Lincoln. Fortunately, we don't have to speculate any more than we have to speculate about whether Escalante is a fake or not, since two famous groups active today, one highly religious and one highly secular, have done just that for many years. Let me take the Amish first. In 1896, there were exactly 5,000 Old Order Amish in the United States, and they were committed to the ideal that every one of their descendants would have an independent livelihood, even those not too swift mentally or favored by nature. 100 years later, in a tremendously hostile climate in the state of Pennsylvania, and probably elsewhere, there are 150,000 Old Order Amish, a 3,000% increase. And they're still so committed. 85% of their children, when grown, elect to continue the Amish way, even though the community is spectacularly prosperous and its Lancaster branch, the largest, is embedded in the center of secular prosperity and temptations. The Puritan culture collapsed under such circumstances in a very short time, but the Amish have thrived. The Amish refuse to go beyond eighth grade. None has a college degree, and they wouldn't even go that far except the law forces them to. A concession the Amish agreed to only if their demands for neighborhood schools, which actively honor the Amish way, were provided. Now consider that virtually 100% of these people is engaged in an independent business or an independent farm. The percentages are divided about 50-50. And consider further that Johns Hopkins University last year, upon studying Amish business practice, announced that only 1 in 20 of their operations go belly up in 5 years, compared with, get ready for this, 17 out of 20 non-Amish enterprises. And consider even further that not a single Amisher uses a computer, uses electricity, drives a motor car, or owns a convenient telephone. As I understand it, and I may be wrong, the telephone has to be far enough away that on the way to the phone, you have a chance to think whether you really need to make the call. But it's something like that. And you have a rough and ready index this way, how far you and I have been flim-flammed by the futurists, by the commercial media, and by forced schooling. According to Mudsill bell curve theory, these facts aren't just strange, they are impossible. And next time you hear that your children had better toe the line if they hope to survive in the global economy, remember the Amish. Why should you raise children to be hired hands anyway? The Amish don't. Where you and I sit perched on the cusp of the 21st century in a nation which seems to be losing the thread of its national story, the Amish world or Lincoln's world of independent producers seems only a daydream. Yet blink your eyes and what appears out of the fog of dependency and giantism our factory schools have helped to generate is another inspiring example. The Mondragon Cooperative in the Basque region of northwest Spain, a resolutely secular association of 120,000 families, oh, half a million people perhaps, committed to the goal that every single kid will be a principal in some independent, useful business venture. In existence for half a century, the cooperative schools are much closer to what Thomas Jefferson wanted American schools to be, places that teach useful knowledge, human rights, knowledge of how to defend those rights, an understanding of the human heart and the human record, and freedom from the intimidation of experts. Much more like Jefferson's dream than American schools, certainly.
Mondragon has existed through depressions and recessions without a single year of negative economic growth. And the per capita income of its co-operators in 1996 is substantially higher than the United States average, while its crime, suicide, divorce, and drug rates, like those of the Amish, are close to zero. Is there a lesson for us here? For both Amish and Mondragoners, it is as if the giant socialistic governments, the giant international corporations, the colossal hospitals, social work establishments, colleges, and institutional public schools have been declared irrelevant to human happiness and prosperity. It suggests a third way to proceed, which I confess has loomed larger and larger in my own thinking for quite some time now. But I know, and I have saved the best for last, I know some of you are thinking, John, this is a scientific present, and it will be a scientific future. We are addicted to novelty and discovery now, and without the kind of lockstep school pyramids we employ, no fresh lives could discover how the science trick is done. Well, maybe, but I don't think so. Because of all the important scientific projects going on in the world right now, none, absolutely none, is more awesome or even close than the Human Genome Project. Its director, Francis Collins, age 45, is at the top of the power prestige scale in international science, and many, many corporations are lined up anticipating fortunes in revenue from project discoveries. Suppose we look at Collins himself. To what does he attribute his unusual power and prestige in the scientific community? Well, according to the New York Times, from which I drew all the information you're about to hear, quote, Dr. Collins suggested it was his unusual upbringing that imparted such a thirst for knowledge. Dr. Collins grew up on a sheep farm in rural Western Virginia. It was a hard life, he said, and his mother, distrusting the education provided in Virginia schools, and quote, not about to relegate the early learning of her four sons to them, decided to teach her children at home, a homeschooler. Well, Mother Collins must have been a masterful teacher herself, a regular Escalante, right, obsessed with science. Wouldn't that be your guess? You would be wrong. Listen as Collins tells it, quote, it was a bit disorganized, Dr. Collins says. I'm sure it would not have been deemed appropriate by authorities had they known. The Collins boys, all four of them, would explore a topic like the origin of words for a week or two or three or four or six, doing nothing else, then they would move on to another interest. As a result, said Collins, he grew up with an unquenchable curiosity and love of learning. Now, what kind of nonsense is this? There's no Piaget and stage theory here, no standardized assessments, no socialization except with sheep. A world-famous scientist in charge of an epic-making project? Yes, I'm afraid so. But that's not all the interesting news about Dr. Collins. So get ready to grab your heart for the next piece. Although he tells us he was raised without any religious training at all by a free-thinking mother, at the age of 27, while at medical school, he decided to become a serious Christian. Well, did he have a vision? No, the answer is considerably more commonplace. Quote, I came at it, said Collins, from an intellectual point of view. The decision was intellectually inescapable, close quote. According to the New York Times, Collins is a deeply religious man, not afraid to talk about his faith, even though it makes his colleagues very uneasy. If you need any more compelling evidence that government compulsion schooling is not what it appears to be, you could hardly ask for a more dramatic testimonial than this one from a world-class scientist trained by his free-thinking mother on a sheep farm in Western Virginia with methods the authorities would not allow had they known, who became a self-inspired, born-again Christian at the age of 27. That's the Human Genome Project, folks. I worry a lot less about it now that I know who's in charge. I think it's time we all acknowledged how political and religious the structure of forced schooling really must be. All curricula and emphases, except the most basic, will either secure things as they are or disestablish them. So school has to be political. There's no escape from it. It's not a polar either-or thing, of course, but the cumulative effect of centralizing control usually tends in one direction: consumption over production, dependency over self-sufficiency, obedience instead of self-command. Mudsill theory in its many forms has indoctrinated the American leadership with an outlook on ordinary people as masses and classes, simplified consumption units, biologically incompetent for much other than to be held in a low-level, semi-narcotized state. See, I even carry around my zapper with me. Until public policy finally decides what to do with them in a microchip age, it doesn't require much imagination to figure out what eventually the answer has to be. We have to scrap Mudsill theory before Mudsill theory scraps us. We've had a belly full of experts, think tanks, and mandates from centralized control centers. We've had a belly full of scare propaganda about bogus international competition and America falling behind. Flax and Hypemeisters have been selling that same tale since 1831. It's only the particular nation we're falling behind at the moment that changes. England, Germany, Russia, Japan, the Asian Tigers have all had their turn as the favorite bogeyman, and I note with horror that China is surely being readied to assume that role of antagonist in the endlessly Hegelian, Hobbesian dialectic that keeps this strange economy running. Well, it doesn't work. These hysterical scare tactics don't work for very long, and they make real-life problems meaningless, and eventually they bring social chaos in their train. 1 minute, Marshall. Time we begin on the long, slow, painful road into a different future than the one official sources are selling us. There is no easy way to get there. A lot of us are going to suffer in the transformation, but holding the present course is lunacy. People live better lives generating their own lines of meaning about what to do and what to think and where to work. Children grow up stronger and better when they learn love and duty in families, neighborhoods, and local communities, and not from national, international propaganda agencies. People need to self-direct. They need to control their own lives, no matter how inconvenient that is for systems builders and systems thinkers. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, how will it be? The question and answer period, or an immediate departure to rather mediocre chips and dip? Well, I don't see anybody leaving the room, John. No. Those that are doing the videotaping and audio taping, I think this is going to be a 90-minute tape, not a 60-minute tape, so prepare themselves. We have our microphone over here for asking of questions. We need a new volunteer. I lost my photographer. He had another meeting, and I had a mental lapse. So I'm going to go down there and start it, but I need some volunteer to come up here and train him on the fly of how to handle the question desk. So, oh, there she is. Those of you who are on email and have seen Wumblegarten, this is Wumblegarten, Gail Remish. So take it away, question and answer period. And by the way, last time I saw Jaime Escalante, it was about three or four weeks ago, and I go up to Sacramento, we get together and chat sometime, and he said, have John, because I tried to put you guys, have him call me or see me or come over, but he thinks so highly of you too, and these guys, we've got to get together a little bit.
You give this audience a real choice, Marshall. The Green Bay game's on, but go ahead.
In fact, I'm pretty sure that's where our photographer is. By his accent, you can tell he's from Wisconsin or something. Okay, questioners, line up over here. We beg that you allow us to take your picture. And before you ask your question while you're in line, please fill out one of the little slips of paper. And so everybody is, and announce yourself as your name, your location, and then your question.
Jerry Mintz from the Alternative Education Resource Organization. Hi, John.
Hi, Jerry. The last question Jerry asked me was about ammonium nitrate fertilizer in somewhere in Indianapolis.
Yes, Jerry. First comment is maybe the book title would be good with just a question mark at the end of it. The Empty Child question mark.
Thank you, Jerry.
Okay.
That might said, tell them all, you'll think about it.
I mean, that might solve your problem and theirs, you know. Okay, next thing is, you know, you talk about, well, this theory, and I think it's very interesting, but if they can't even, you know, decide whether O.J. did it, you know, how are you going to really convince people that these things really happened? That's one question. And for example, relating to this is the idea that, for example, you say, well, okay, there were the schools happening during this time, but also what happened during that period of time you're talking about is television came in. People could say, well, that may have something to do with the rates of illiteracy. And one final thing about that, I didn't feel like your database was very accurate, because during World War II you had much more of a cross-section of people fighting, for example, and than you did later on in the subsequent wars.
Thank you, Jerry. Which of those clauses would you like me to respond to?
Anyone you want.
Okay. Now, obviously, the cause of this thing is very, very complicated. What was missing in the really hundreds and hundreds of books I read for my own purposes, to answer my own questions, was something that could explain the zeal, the shining behind the eyes. These passionate statements, which read aloud in front of an audience, really sound creepy, but obviously all the people making them had three-piece suits and titles and affiliations with Princeton. I was looking for some explanation. It wasn't enough to say what I felt to be true, that this is a religion. On the policy level, it's a religion. And I said, surely if it is, people are proud of their faith, and if I look hard enough, I'm going to find statements, open statements of what the religion aims for, what its gospel is. And I must tell you that once the can of worms about evolutionary theory is opened up and you go back to the primary documents, you will find that the open statements of relief that finally a new religious purpose has been discovered by the human mind, the control of evolution, so that it can be a goal of all generations, of the bad blood to die out, but feel grateful that it was given a chance to opt for that course, and for the good blood to know that it will improve and improve and improve. Let me tell you that some people that I had read with certainly awe and respect, although with a difficult time understanding, like Teilhard de Chardin, I suddenly found to be located solidly in this evolutionary religion. Once you've been warned of it, you'll find clues yourself everywhere. That's the only clause I remember, Jerry, because I was trying to think of the poor Green Bays and how they might be faring right now. Giants won 20-6. Yes, sir.
Fred Flip, excuse me, from East Lansing, Michigan. One of the biggest objections to separating school and state, as I'm sure you know, is what about the poor? I gather from your comments
that anybody who's taught school, that's the greatest piece of nonsense of all. The schools as they are damage the poor much, much worse than they damage people who have alternative sources of relief. The first third of my teaching career, I taught people who call themselves middle class and who were upper middle class and rich on the Gold Coast of Manhattan's West Side, mostly people from the entertainment community and television. The second half of my career, I taught an eclectic group of kids who had been identified as emotionally disturbed. They hadn't been told that, but they had all, nor had their parents, but they were all moved out of harm's way into a school on the edge of the district. Or about, in the last third of my career, I taught the kids from Harlem, Spanish Harlem, exclusively. The first thing I noticed was how close together all these groups were in their capacity to deal with abstraction, with complex ideas. The differences were very, very superficial, and they had been rigorously enforced by class placement, by deliberate withdrawal of complex material, by removing an experience base, because what on earth does an abstraction mean if you don't have an experience base? What does the word democracy mean to someone who's been well-schooled? Where is there a scrap of, whether you agree or disagree with democratic theory, where is there a scrap of it in the school environment? So these abstractions can be very well handled by kids from more prosperous families. But in fact, they have no idea what they're talking about. I think they're in the truest sense of the word, have been made parasites, and they're in some condition of demi-insanity. So I tried to test my theory by what would be called advanced intellectual exercises, pulling no punches with the dumbest kids in the school. And I tell you, the response was not heartening, it was electrifying. I had consistently over 30 years of teaching less trouble with any of the groups I taught, not because I'm a very nice person, because I'm not. I tend to be abrasive and come on strong all the time, and I don't let people get away with betraying themselves. I mean, I'm not worried about being insulted, but I found the Harlem class is exceedingly responsive. In fact, I embarrassed the school district so badly because we consistently won most of the intellectual awards in the district that I found it necessary to get out of there before they used ammonium nitrate, Jerry.
My question is, then, is the question, what about the poor? Is it essentially, in light of...
It's a nonsense question.
And is it essentially, what about the empty children and their empty parents? Is that the philosophy driving that question?
My experience with the parents of the poor, not to say that there weren't many disabilities, but that was the same experience I had with the parents of the prosperous on the west side of Manhattan, if they could ever be found. I think that you have as much right to good treatment if you're rich as if you're poor. But I found equal bad treatment, because when you make people irresponsible by removing responsibility from them, where's the big surprise when they act irresponsibly? We have removed the major responsibility of parenthood from parents. I'm surprised that so many parents are still responsible in the face of that. Yes, sir.
Earl Fox from Ambridge, Pennsylvania. I lost track of your Jaime Escalante story. I assumed that he had been attacked by the school system.
He was attacked by virtually everyone, and his life was made. His mail was stolen. His bed was short-sheeted. No, that was bad. I'm from Monongahela. That's bad Western Pennsylvania. We're neighbors.
Yes, so he was attacked because of his success?
Because of his success. School teaching is a guild. Not to say there aren't hundreds of thousands, maybe a million, if you find people who teach school, but it's a guild. And the way a guild works, forget the propaganda for a moment, nobody in a guild was allowed to move new technology in unless the whole guild agreed and everyone used it. No one in a guild was allowed to advertise different techniques or different goals. The guild was a colonial organism. So when Escalante takes exceedingly stupid kids, obviously I'm doing that with quotes around the word, exceedingly stupid kids who have been given up on because what are they, just dumb wetbacks, and even if you love them, you just love those dumb wetbacks for whatever reason. When he took them and they repeatedly trounced the kids from Palo Alto, you know, where Stanford is, and Hollywood High, in advanced mathematics, when they had no tradition of that at all, we certainly could say that Escalante must have been an unusual teacher, but that wasn't it. The main method he used, is Kathy Duffy here? Where's Kathy? I once called to find out. The main method Escalante used is being offered for free by the man who invented it. It's the Saxon math method is what Escalante used. Now, he also used an awful lot of body English and passion and others, but the math technology was Saxon math. That's the third highest performing school in the United States and far and away the highest performing school in advanced math in the state of California. Come on, give me a break. It means virtually anyone could have gotten similar results to somewhere in the ballpark. And Saxon offers in huge two-page ads about once every 2 months his whole program free to any school that wants to take. They don't have to pay for it. Saxon will just give it to them as long as they promise to use it. I think for 2 years, but don't hold me to that. And he's a wacky guy who was an ex-Air Force colonel who failed math in college 3 times. And he came to the conclusion that the reason he failed was not that he was stupid or unmathematical, but that the information was presented in such a way that most people couldn't get it. So he sat down, this math failure, and reconfigured the presentation mode. Now, I'm hardly arguing it's the best or the second. I don't know, frankly, but I do know that where the method is used, it embarrasses the neighboring school districts. And Escalante used it. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Cheryl Battles from Maryland. I'm a homeschooling mother. And
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
What are you going to name it?
Yeah, you get that manner of with.
I just want to say that it was exciting to hear you tell us about how Abraham Lincoln was wise to Malthus, and that he was arguing, you know, trying to refute his theories.
Wisconsin Agricultural Association. It's a famous speech. He wasn't president then, but he was aware that some change was taking place in the, you know, in the climate of discussion among important people, and he traced it to British money.
That just would seem like a really powerful argument to bring out for activists, you know, if in our writings or whatever, that Abraham Lincoln said these things. But my question, I wanted to ask you about the Amish and about standardized testing.
Okay, my source of information about the Amish is a book published, 2 books published by Johns Hopkins.
Well, actually, what I wanted to mention is my daughter, I brought her some magazines from the public library, American Girl, and there was an article in there about the Amish, and it said that the Amish were sending their children to the public schools, and the public school buses were coming, picking them up, taking them to the public schools, and I just wonder what you thought about that.
I don't think anything
about
it.
I don't think this was Lancaster. I think it might have been out in Oregon or something.
I'm too divorced from the particulars of the situation. Although I did spend 3 days in Barnesville, Ohio, with a large group of Amish last year at the second Luddite conference. They had participated, and I think as observers to see what was going on. And one fellow said to me, the Amish could build a rocket to the moon if they thought it was worth doing. I do know that Johns Hopkins, which is a resolutely secular university, one of the most important of its type, a German research university, published 2 books last year about the Amish, both by a man named Donald Krabill, K-R-A-Y-B-I-L-L, and the data in them is electrifying about Amish success in competition with people who do use computers, telephones, and on and on.
I just wonder why they would want to undercut what they're doing with their children by sending them.
It's not that I doubt what you're saying. It's just I don't have any awareness at all. It's always a good idea, I think, to try to go to the source rather than to take a secondary source when you read something like that, because there is a genuine vested interest, and it doesn't have to be conspiratorial. There's just a vested interest in taking groups that have been marginalized and keeping them marginalized one way or another. Right.
Okay, about the standardized testing.
Yeah.
I know that standardized testing cannot measure if you're going to be a great scientist or a great.
Can you measure whether you can read?
That's what I.
It's horrifying.
It cannot measure if you can read.
Well, I used to run a test once a year. It's just what the standardized test does is take about 150 kinds of categories of information. that reading transmits. And you and I could argue whether it's 170 or 130, but there's an awful lot of them. And it picks out six or seven of them, like, what would be the best title for this selection? And sometimes that's worded, what's the main idea of this? And it over and over asks these same six or seven categories. As a consequence, before a kid gets very old, I mean long before they're in fifth grade, they figured the game out. And when they read, they don't read. They read for the information, the categories of information that's tested. You can test this yourself. I mean, by some accident, I had a hunch this was going on. And I used to take an extremely simple book that's in every library, probably in the world, but certainly in the United States. It was the leading war novel of the First World War, All Quiet on the Western Front, Erich Maria Remarque. I used to take that book, written in one and two syllable words, with little chapters that are no more than 1,500 words long, told from the perspective of a German teenager who's a soldier, so everything's seen in this simplified, simplistic way. And I would ask questions from that book that weren't of the type, they weren't trick questions, they just weren't of the type that were asked in the standardized reading test. At first, I was just shocked when whole classes of gifted and talented kids, out of whole classes, maybe one or two would get one or two questions right and they'd miss all the others. So I decided to make it an open book test. And let me tell you, the results were no better without, they couldn't see the information in front of their eyes. I knew then that I'd stumbled onto something really profound, I thought, some diminution of intellect.
But even though they do have their flaws, and everybody, you know, agrees that they have their flaws, if we didn't have the standardized test, like, for example, the National Education Association is the biggest proponent to do away with standardized testing, and if they're successful, how are homeschoolers going to verify that we're doing a good job and that our kids are testing?
I'm going to step away from the mic. Let me calm down.
Okay.
No, this is serious, and I don't mean at all to hold your question in contempt. Because unless questions like this are asked and answered with some conviction, I think we all get further and further away from an obvious truth that most of us can tell. When you interview somebody for a job, and 300 people are out there, do you really give everybody the hour or two to plumb their pen? Can't you tell in the first minute whether at least this person could fit into the last category that you'll investigate close? How do you know whether someone has a decent haircut or not, or whether their clothes fit? Almost everything can be assessed by having a reasonable amount of life experience. Kids used to come to me, teenage boys love to draw comic book stuff, copy from the book. They'd come to me and ask me, and I used to get furious with them. I'd say, how on earth would I know? I don't read comic books, but you can take the comic book and you can compare the two. And if they're identities, I guess you did what you set out to do. You don't need the verification of an intermediary expert. In the first day, never longer than the second day. I used to make this as a mental bet, and then eventually I'd make it a mental bet with other teachers. You can tell by watching how a class, how individuals, if you look at individuals rather than as a class. You can tell who the A students, the B students, and notice not the bright students, the dumb, who the A, the B, and the C students are. By the way they hold their heads, by the way they hold their pencil, by the way they shape their questions. You're hardly ever wrong. That's the horrifying thing. So that information hardly tells you who the best person to build a house with is, or be in a foxhole with is, or put together a business with is. All it tells you is who's going to do well on standardized tests.
It does tell basic academics. Thank you, Mr. Gatto.
I'll talk with anybody. It's probably the wrong place, although Marshall could set up an adversary, because there's hardly time, and I imagine that the question's not always everybody's interest. I don't mind. I mean, Italians can talk forever.
Well, her question might be better than mine. My name is Bruce Dimmitt. I'm from Kansas. I heard you say that the bell curve did not explain the geometric increase in the illiteracy rate after World War II. And I've heard you say that a good teacher, conscientious teacher, can teach students that other teachers think are hopeless.
Well, the first statement's accurate. The second is not. That doesn't represent my position. I don't think that the teaching function is very important. I'll be very honest with you. The learning function, the student side, the student investment, is about 95% of the equation. And we couldn't run schools, even good schools, if we really acknowledge that. So we have to make it appear that there's some decisive difference that's supplied by the teacher, and I flatly don't believe that's so.
Okay, my question is, are you saying that there is no bell curve?
No, in every human activity, a bell curve will emerge, or some sort of a curve will emerge, a distribution curve. What it doesn't tell you is the innate power of the mind. It doesn't tell you how permanent its configuration is going to be. It's for that minute. It's a really limited piece of information with one huge exception. If you decide that the bell that emerges in first grade and second grade is going to be institutionally reinforced, and that's, of course, what virtually all our schools do, including the good ones, then what you get is a self-fulfilling prophecy. The bell does remain semi-permanent or permanent. Very few people escape out of their position on the flanges of the bell. I'm telling you that it's the worst kind of hocus-pocus if you've ever actually taught the way. Is Jacob Hornberger still here? Or he couldn't take it, huh? He is here. It's like raising a family of six as a group of kids, or raising them as Jack and Joan and Tommy, and you can't teach a class of kids. You can do it in a very limited way. It has some utility. Schooling has some utility. It just doesn't have much. Schooling is important. It just isn't very important. Americans always knew this.
Yes. My name is Carl Bundy.
I know, Carl.
Minnesota. I've been following you around the country. This is the fifth time I've traveled to see you.
I get fatter and fatter.
Yeah, there's too much time on the road, I think. Mentioning your forthcoming book and The Bell Curve and some other books, I wanted to ask you about what kind of piles of footnotes you're planning to have in your new huge book, because thinking of The Bell Curve, I think that book had some of its influence because of a large number of footnotes that most people never then used to read the primary sources, which The Bell Curve misrepresented badly, as a matter of fact.
My college roommate, Edward J. Epstein, who became the legendary assassinations expert, I think set the record in a book about Lee Harvey Oswald, or the one that followed it, in which the back notes were longer than the book. And I believe he was given credit for that in the New York Review of Books, being the very first to have the gall to do that. Now many, many do that. I was sitting there on an enormous file of documentation, and all of a sudden, it struck me that I was playing the same game that I was attacking. What footnotes are is the verification that German scholarship, German university scholarship, that said research and writing is the important thing, not teaching. It came to dominate the American college scene. And in fact, it's just as easy to lie with footnotes as anyone who's ever used them knows. You can say a book says anything because almost nobody ever goes back to the book. And every once in a while, some snotty publication like New York Review of Books will do that, and they almost never find that the footnotes say what they're supposed to.